This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetteSurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at NECU.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Among the 65,000 books written about the Civil War that ended 150 years ago last month, there are histories detailing dates and casualties and decisive battles. There are excellent portraits of generals and politicians and the perspectives of soldiers and slaves. A new graphic novel presents the war that shattered the country through a series of objects: a bullet, a flag, a pair of opera glasses, and reinforcing perspectives of history from the ground up, a bug. Not just any bug, but a mosquito with a belly full of malaria infecting soldiers and citizens. These ordinary objects become remarkable tools for a book that tells the story of a war that transformed the nation. It's called Battle Lines, a graphic history of the Civil War by the historian Ari Kelman and the author and illustrator Jonathan Fetter-Vorm, who joins us now with more. And we spoke to him previously about his graphic novel, Trinity. Jonathan, welcome back to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you.
The war that shattered a nation, the sheer brutality and the numbers of the dead and wounded and the social changes that came after. Remind us, if you would, of the scope of the devastation.
It's really hard for us to imagine now, given the conditions in which we live, in which war seems like such a distant occurrence. But the Civil War was taking place in people's backyards. People were fighting from all over the country. And in fact, it was one of the first times that a lot of residents from places like the Middle East or Middle West and the far Northeast ever got to see the South. It was transformative in a way that made people from all across the country visit other places within it. It was a vast migration of troops and material, which, you know, says nothing about the cost of lives and livelihoods.
Mm. And you could present a different type of history. All of the chapters begin with objects. We have a brick, a bullet, a pair of opera glasses, and in the first chapter, a flag. Now, how did you arrive at this device for telling the story?
Well, this I have to give full credit to my co-author, Ari Kelman. He was the one who first proposed this idea of the Civil War. It was actually while I was working on Trinity. My editor passed this proposal along, and I was a bit skeptical at first. Doing a graphic history of the Civil War is a daunting task. It's such a huge topic to cover. But when I read this proposal, I was blown away by this idea of using objects. It was very surprising. So this was really Ari's, the seed that he nurtured in this story. And we worked back and forth on figuring out which objects we were going to stick with, and some were a little easier to work with than others. Some of his original ideas included things like the bacterium that causes dysentery, and the story was supposed to be told from the inside of a dying soldier's stomach, and which would have been wild, but I could not for the life of me figure out how to draw that.
And we mentioned that the first chapter is about the flag. This is about the attack on Fort Sumter in April of 1861. And we find out from your book the war's first casualty was a self-inflicted wound. What's the story there?
Well, this was a crazy discovery for me. I actually came into this project without knowing much about the Civil War. The bombardment that happened at Fort Sumter, which is regarded as the real opening salvo of the war. There were some skirmishes before that, but this was when both belligerents really first started to engage each other. It lasted for days, but both sides were so well entrenched behind very thick stone walls that there really wasn't much in damage in terms of these shells hitting people, just smashing into rocks. And then when it was very clear that Fort Sumter had to surrender, that the Confederate bombardment was going to take this fort, the one condition of surrender was that the Union troops got to salute their flag as they took it down off the flagpole. And it was during this, I don't remember if it was 50 or 100-gun salute, that one of the cannons malfunctioned, and it blew up a powder magazine, injuring and eventually killing a couple soldiers who were participating in the salute. So these were the first casualties of the Civil War.
Friendly fire, if you will. Mm-hmm. You draw this book all in muted colors, designed to look like, you know, faded newspapers or sepia-toned photos of the time. What was behind that choice?
Well, the photos, that's really the touchstone. This was one of the first wars that was so heavily photographed because it coincided with the popular dispersal of this photographic technology. So we have a huge trove of photographs to draw from, and I really wanted to try to capture that kind of sort of nostalgic, faded look, but also very, very precise, very sharp.
There is a chapter called A Photograph, and many of us have, of course, seen those horrific photos of the field after the Battle of Gettysburg, just littered with bodies of humans and horses frozen where they fell, including one that is often seen. It's sometimes called the gardener's home of a rebel sharpshooter. Now, in your retelling of it, that was a staged photograph. Did that happen?
It did. There's some controversy about exactly what was involved in that picture, but there are other photographs that historians have identified as containing the same soldier and the same gun, but in different places nearby. And so the general consensus is that this was a photograph that was arranged for effect, that likely this was a sharpshooter's den, but the body that you see in that iconic photograph was not necessarily where it was when Gardner happened upon it.
So the mythology of war was already at work, or even as the battles, you know, the bodies were falling.
Yeah, the narrative, a lot of what Ari and I were trying to do with this book was talking about the construction of the story of the Civil War, how even as it was happening, people were figuring out how they wanted to remember it and how they wanted to think about it. And as we find throughout the book, this is something that is still going on today. We're still constructing the story.
Mm-hmm. So what were you using as sources? Because you do have a number of personal stories, a runaway slave, a wife left behind to take care of her family and farm while her husband is fighting. How did you come up with these kind of concepts and the dialogue between them?
Well, all the sources, a lot of them were taken from secondary material or from the letters and diaries of people who experienced the war itself. So the chapter that you bring up about the woman left behind in the South, this was set ostensibly during the Richmond Bread Riots. And there's some great documentary sources of people who kept diaries during those moments. And so there's a mixture of characters who are created from documentary sources and then real life figures who lived through the time.
Yeah, and we can see the difference in the text, you know, that the letters written by people are written in a different sort of font than
exactly.
The stories. And we do in this book also get the broad strokes of history. But I'm wondering about, for you, any of these narratives, the ground-up stories, just shock or surprise or particularly grip you?
There were a lot of them that were difficult to draw, if only because the stories were things that I had not expected. There's the extended chapter, I think it's chapter 11, Death Letter, which tells the story of the battle at Spotsylvania Courthouse, the so-called Bloody Angle, one of the late battles of the war, and it was incredibly gruesome. And in reading soldiers' accounts from the lead-up to that battle, I was, on the one hand, amazed at the poetry of the language of these soldiers who had already experienced years of unimaginable hardship, and they knew that they were coming towards some final showdown in this campaign. And then to hear about the aftermath, and that was what really shocked me, was figuring out how to represent so much destruction that beggars description and imagination, and that even for the people who lived through it, they did not have the words. They couldn't represent it. So really, this was the challenge. How do you draw something like that?
Hmm. And how do you draw loyalty? There's a chapter when General Lee surrendered to General Grant at Appomattox. This was 150 years ago in April. It was a chapter called General Lee's Sword. And we hear the names of so many soldiers fallen. You know, this guy died here and this guy died here. And I didn't even know that guy's name. And he was this kind of moon-faced kid who helped save me. And throughout the panels, this kind of device of General Lee's Sword that slowly begins to fade away. Tell me what you were doing there.
Well, the original thought behind that chapter was something about the construction of the mythology of the end of the war. There was a story that came out after General Lee's surrender, which took place in a farmhouse, and only very few witnesses were there. But there's this story that General Lee offered General Grant his ceremonial saber, and Grant politely and, you know, ceremoniously declined. Nobody knows if this actually happened, but it helped fuels the myth of gentility that surrounds this moment. And so we wanted to start with that without actually having to dramatize that and go into that myth, but I wanted to make something of that sword, that idea of what the sword represents and what the sword would then come to represent in the years and decades after the war. And so throughout the chapter, I follow this soldier as he's going back home to his farm and to his wife and family. And as he gets closer and closer to home, the vision of the sword fades from his imagination, but it never completely goes away.
And when General Grant and General Lee together negotiated the terms of the surrender at that Virginia farmhouse, this soldier, he leaves, he gets picked up on the road, and the old man says to him, "The fight ain't never over." And we think about the battle lines now, or the legacy of the war and the meaning of the war. Perhaps this is going to be the topic of tens of thousands of more books. What are you adding to that conversation?
Well, one of the things that we're doing in this book is introducing a lot of complicating factors into the easy narrative of the war. This is the great contribution that Ari brings to it. He has such a grasp on the historiography and on the legacy of what the war and the remembrance of the war has meant to our current culture. And so at every step of the way, every story that we tell, there is an edge to it that introduces some new wrinkle to the narrative as we think we know it. And the added contribution of doing this in a graphic medium is one of my favorite aspects of it, which is the way that we can introduce this story to a younger audience, to an audience that may not be as likely to read through the masterful tomes that summarize the history of the war. So this is hopefully a grand introduction to all of the themes that you will confront if you're willing to go further into the history of the war.
Well, Jonathan Fetter-Vorm, you've really done an amazing piece of work. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Fetter-Vorm is an illustrator and author with Ari Kelman, an historian of the new book, Battle Lines, A Graphic History of the Civil War. You can see more on the book, including a couple of selections of chapters, at wordofmouthradio.org. There are countless books and films and articles on the Civil War, but there is another, more physical way for people to experience events that took place 150 years ago, historical reenactments. A few years ago, a passionate group of Civil War buffs ceremoniously reenacted a Union funeral, and producer Jake Warga was there.
Ready!
The man we are honoring here is Dr. Benjamin F. Fuller. He served with Company C of the 22nd Pennsylvania Cavalry. God of all nations and Father of us all, listen to our prayers. Give your beloved peace.
Honor detail. Ready.
I'm a colonel.
Steve Betchert.
Aim.
I'm 57.
Fire! Load.
I'm what's called a field officer. I'm a baby boomer that didn't go to Vietnam and didn't ever serve in the military. I spent 35 years in the classroom trying to help students understand the history of their country. War is a terrible, stupid waste of human life. You should do everything you possibly can to avoid it. Okay? This war took the lives of 2% of the entire American population, 620,000 Americans. It changed the country, In the end, it did free the slaves, 4.5 million slaves, and it did unite the country and make it into one nation. People used to say the United States are. After the war, they said the United States is. The whole concept of being a nation came from this war.
Ready. Aim. Fire. Load.
We're both wearing hoop skirts, and then I'm wearing a ball gown. 1860. Okay, I'm Allison Fletcher.
And I'm Carly Welty.
We're 14.
Yeah. It's actually really hard to, like, walk around and stuff. Like, you have to be careful, like, how you sit with the hoop skirts. I liked that time era a lot. And you got to, like, you got to be outside more and stuff. And you got to have, like, everybody had horses. And you got to wear these kinds of clothes and dresses and stuff all the time. It probably feel really scary to feel like somebody else just still living in your own country was against you. And your,
and like the middle,
and what you were fighting
like
for.
The middle states, they had people, like families, some went to Union, some went to the Confederate, so you'd be kind of fighting your own brother.
Yeah.
Well, like, no war is happy.
Yeah. I think war will always be persistent because everybody is always disagreeing on stuff. So, yeah, sadly enough, I don't think there'll ever not be a war.
Ready! Aim! Fire! Freeze, and...
I'm Harold Slavik. I'm the commander of the Edward D. Baker Camp No. 6, Sons of Union Veterans of the Civil War. I've been a Civil War buff for years. My great-great-grandfather got here in time to fight for Company K of the 54th New York Infantry for 2 years. See, we are the descendants of and the heirs of the old Grand Army of the Republic. I am wearing period correct Union uniform. This is called a sack coat. Yes, I was in the Air Force. Well, I was a cook and a baker. I never left the States. Because of finding out about my great-great-grandfather, I can say with great pride, my family has put on the uniform from the Civil War to Vietnam, and I'm very proud of that. We have the best country in the world, bar none, for all of its faults and all of its mistakes. It's still the best damn experiment going. And the fact that I bet was allowed, and my family has been allowed, to pay the rent for being born under that system, that's where the pride comes in.
Ready! Aim! Fire!
That's why we're here, is to tap people on the shoulder of the modern world and say, hello, don't forget us.
And our thanks to Jake Warga, who produced that piece. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Over 1,800 lives were lost, the deadliest maritime disaster in America. But other big headlines to compete with, no book deal and no blockbuster film to tell the story. Chances are you've never heard of the sinking of the Sultana. Being left out of the history books can be a result of bad timing, the wrong place at the wrong time, and even having a name that's hard to rhyme with. Christopher Klein is a freelance writer and author, and he joins us to unearth the reasons behind forgotten history. We found his article, 8 Reasons We Forget Some Historical Events, at the Boston Globe. Welcome to Word of Mouth, Christopher.
Thank you, Virginia.
Thanks for coming in. And tell us more about the Sultana tragedy.
So this happens a couple weeks after the surrender of Robert E. Lee at Appomattox. And you have Union troops who fought in the battlefields down south, many of them who were also prisoners of war at Andersonville and Cahaba. And they survived the battles. They survived the POW camps. And now they're ready to go home. And they board the steamboat to take them up the Mississippi River from Vicksburg, Mississippi, up to Illinois. And it was pretty common at that time to have private steamboat operators to transport troops, and they were paid per head. So the owner and the captain of the Sultana was getting paid $5 a head for every man he put on board, $10 for an officer. And even though he was licensed for 376 passengers, he put 2,400 passengers on the Sultana. Mm. And he knew he had a leaky boiler that could be a problem too, but he didn't want to risk not getting his payday. So he told everyone to just patch the boilers. And the overloaded ship makes its way up the Mississippi River, and in the middle of the night on April 27, 1865, three of the boilers explode, and of the 2,400 men on board, 1,800 of them are suspected to have died in this tragedy.
Absolutely grisly explosion, too, from the sounds of it.
Yeah, I mean, there are hundreds who died instantly just from the force of the explosion, and then it turns the steamboat into a floating inferno. And you have, back in those days, not many people know how to swim. The Mississippi River is swollen at flood stages and freezing, and people had basically make the decision they wanted to die by burning aboard the ship or die by drowning.
Absolute tragedy, but we hear so little about it.
Right.
Is it just because there was no film like the Titanic made about it?
That's part of the reason. And what really buries the Sultana in our collective memory is it's really a victim of poor timing. It happens the day after John Wilkes Booth is cornered and shot in a barn in Virginia. The body of Abraham Lincoln is still making its way across the country to its final resting place in Springfield, Illinois. There are still Civil War generals who are surrendering their troops out on the field. So it's sort of a victim of very busy news time. And then also, you know, it's the country was numb at that point. Whereas today, you know, 1,800 people die. Of course, it's going to be just huge news. But in the Civil War, when you had 600,000 soldiers who died, you know, another 1,800 was sort of just a blip on the radar.
I'm thinking about bad timing. Remember the fertilizer explosion in Texas?
That's right.
At just about the same time, maybe a day or two after the Boston bombing.
Yep.
Completely wiped off of the headlines. Well, but this story does have, it has greed, you know, it has tragedy, it has a sense of heroism. Isn't that a kind of narrative that we would want to remember?
You know, I think that there are a lot of instructive lessons that are in there that would make for a very interesting story. And there have been a number of authors who have written books about it, but it just doesn't have the same connection as the Titanic does in our mind, because the Titanic is just this classic story. And, you know, that's what we remember, that story part of history. You have this mighty ship that is
feat of engineering, right?
Yeah, even the name Titanic, you know, it's you couldn't make that up. And it's a story about hubris and how the mighty will fall. And it has those classic storylines to go back to the days, you know, of the Odyssey. And the Titanic, of course, the victims were rich and famous. And, you know, people tend to gravitate to those kinds of stories as opposed to the men who were the soldiers on the Sultana.
Right. How about location? I mean, this is in the middle of the Mississippi River. It's not like Gettysburg. There's a battlefield. Does location make a difference
location
in whether or not?
Location makes a big difference. And events that happen in major media centers are going to be remembered a lot more than an event such as Sultana, which took place outside Mississippi, you know, sort of on the further reaches of where most of America was at that time. So that definitely plays a lot into it. And you will find in the course of history, you're going to remember these events that happen in big metropolitan areas. And a great example is we all remember the Great Chicago Fire, October 6, 1871. Wasn't even the deadliest fire that night. Just 250 miles to the north, there was a fire roaring through the lumber towns of Wisconsin, killed 10 times as many people as in Chicago. In fact, when they go to phone the governor to tell him about the fire, he's not there. He's in Chicago helping with the relief efforts. Mm. You know, we all have Mrs. O'Leary's cow sort of stuck in our collective mythological memories. But it, as I said, it wasn't even the deadliest fire that night.
Well, there are a lot of names that get sort of attached to these histories. Of course, Paul Revere. Why was Paul Revere remembered while others were not?
Well, Paul Revere basically got the biggest PR coup of his life 40 years after he died. And that was when Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. And Longfellow's poem botched a lot of the history. But it was a very memorable poem that school children were taught. And that's sort of the version of history that they remembered. The biggest person who gets left in history is the other writer that night, William Dawes. And you can make the argument that William Dawes had a tougher task than Paul Revere did on the night of April 18th, 1775, whereas Revere was crossing the water to get to Lexington and Concord. William Dawes had to get past the British guards by land, and he was able to sneak past those British guards and had a longer route to take to get out to Lexington and Concord. So he was just as much of a patriot hero as Revere was, yet we don't really remember him as much as Paul Revere.
Why do we remember some historical events and others are lost to the dustbin, as they say? Well, we're speaking with the writer Christopher Klein. He has come up with 8 reasons why we forget some historical events. A pretty instructive way to look at history going forward. It's also who we choose to remember. You write about Ona Judge and her legacy here in New Hampshire, barely remembered. Now, who was she and why do you think we've chosen not to celebrate her?
So Ona Judge is a slave living in Philadelphia in the 1790s, and she is about 20 years old, and she fled her master's house, gets on a boat and sails to Portsmouth and mixes in with the communities up here in New Hampshire. But what makes it notable is who her master was. And her master was George Washington, Martha Washington. And the house that she had left was the president's house. And she settled up here. And under the fugitive slave law that George Washington had signed into law, she could be brought back to Philadelphia to her owners. And the president did try to get some of his operatives to get her to come back to Philadelphia, but was unsuccessful in doing so. And I came across this story when I was reading this book by Andrew Carroll. It was called Here Is Where, and he was taking a look at these sort of forgotten historical tales, these unmarked historical sites, and he told this story about Ona Judge, and she lived in Greenland, New Hampshire, and that's where she died, and she's buried there. But the plot of her house, her gravesite, is basically unmarked. It's out in the middle of the woods. And, you know, he raised the question why this person who really embodies the motto of the Granite Estate, you know, live free or die, why isn't she remembered as much? And part of it is, you know, we know sort of that George Washington was a slaveholder, but we really don't want to think too hard about it, right? You know, it's one of these aspects that we build up our heroes and we don't necessarily want to see some of these flaws that in real ways are make them human or ways for us to connect with them. But we put them on these mythological pedestals and we don't want to learn these stories necessarily that that show some of the sides that we don't want to see about them.
Right. Accuracy is not always the province of history. Rosa Parks, for example, was not the first woman of color to say, I do not want to ride in the back of the bus. Who was Claudette Colvin and why didn't she make the cut as the hero of the civil rights movement?
So she is a 15-year-old girl. And she is the first African-American to be arrested for not giving up her seat on the bus. The NAACP was looking to bring a test case, and they dug a little bit more into Claudette's backstory. But she had one aspect to her that the NAACP didn't think would present a great image, and that she was pregnant. She's an unwed prospective mother. And that did not fit the image of who they wanted to put out in front to be the face of this civil rights case. So they decide not to use Claudette. Rosa Parks, a few months later, she's arrested on the bus, and she fits more of the type, the more dignified older woman. She works as a seamstress at the department store. She's the face that they want to put out in front. So even though she's not the first person to be arrested, she is the person that we remember in history.
So what are the types of stories that we tend to keep out of our history books? Those unpleasant, they remind us of something we don't want to see. It's like, I don't know, it's like retrofitting history to suit our tastes.
Yeah, I mean, we have this tendency to whitewash history. As I said, we want to have these heroes that we put up front. And that also means that we tend to forget about history that don't have any natural leaders to them. Historians I spoke to for this piece, Ray Raphael, he makes the point that grassroots movements tend to get lost in history because by their nature, they do not have charismatic leaders. And he was talking even about Shays' Rebellion that happened in the early years of the Republic. And Daniel Shays was hardly even involved in the movement. But we put Daniel Shays into this leadership position that he never had. And we remember Shays' rebellion because we remember Daniel Shea. And there was no Daniel Shea even put there by history. We probably wouldn't remember as much. So we remember those stories that have heroes. We remember those stories that glorify and extol those virtues that we want to feel, not only about the historical figures, but about ourselves as well. And there's stories that are out there that don't necessarily present the image that we want to have about ourselves, then we might forget them.
How can we remedy our collective forgetfulness?
I think what we need to do is we need to read about history, okay? I mean, these stories that I came across are ones that I never learned in school. And I think just the more you expose yourself to history, the more that you read about it, you're going to come across even these little kernels of information. We need to put out historical markers. We need to have these public events, commemorations, those things that lend ourselves into the collective memory. And that's how we build memories for future generations as well. I mean, there's a lot of value to a field trip. And kids who go on field trips to these historical places, that's where they get their, that's where they learn these stories. And the more that we can expose children to these stories, then we can sort of resuscitate some of these stories that have been lost to history.
Christopher Klein, freelance writer and author, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We found Christopher's piece, 8 Reasons We Forget Some Historical Events, at the Boston Globe, and you can learn more about the history we left behind by reading his article. That's at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In April of 1865, less than a week after General Robert E. Lee's surrender of the Confederacy, a nation beleaguered by a 4-year war was reeling once again. President Abraham Lincoln had been assassinated. As word of the president's death spread, the public mourned his loss. Mostly. The United States had been divided by a contentious war that famously pitted brother against brother. And while many citizens lamented the loss of the leader, others cheered, and not only in the South. Martha Hodes is professor of history at New York University and the author of the book Mourning Lincoln, which delves into the aftermath of the tragedy 150 years ago. Martha Hodes, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much.
So what was the state of the Union when Lincoln was shot on April the 14th, Good Friday, we should add, 1865?
Well, the war had just ended, the Confederacy had just surrendered, and all sides were relieved in many ways. Union supporters were jubilant. Confederates were in complete despair. And then on top of both of those feelings and emotions came the assassination, the nation's first presidential assassination.
How did people find out about the shooting and death of Lincoln?
Well, the Telegraph, wherever the Telegraph ran, the newspaper journalists would go to the Telegraph offices, get the telegrams, and print the headlines. So the Telegraph and newspapers spread the word as early as that day. But what's really fascinating is, as the newspaper boys ran through the streets, the first people to get the news were laborers who were up early in the morning cooking for their masters, building fires, the milkman delivering the milk. And so the working classes got the news first and often delivered it to their masters.
Hmm. Did people believe it? Did they have to somehow verify it?
Oh, people didn't believe it. It was literally incredible, literally unbelievable. People wrote in their diaries and in letters that they were stupefied, astounded. People invoked the metaphor of a thunderbolt from a clear blue sky. A former slave said she felt an electric shock to my soul. It was simply too horrible and too terrible to believe. Mm. People said it was like a play on a stage. So today we would say, I felt like I was in a movie.
Was there any, you know, we didn't have photographs then. There were no newspapers or videos, certainly shouted about the internet. Did they need proof somehow that it actually happened?
Yes, that's such a good question, because now, of course, we think we would turn to our televisions, we turn to our cell phones, and we turn to social media. What people did in 1865 was they turned to the human face, so not Facebook, but human faces. So they immediately, when they saw the newspaper headlines, they ran outside. The first thing to do was to look into other people's faces. If other people's faces were stricken, if tears were rolling down their cheeks, men and women, then they knew they weren't dreaming. They weren't in a play on a stage, and that was a major means of verification.
This was, as you mentioned, the first presidential assassination with no precedent for what should happen in these kind of cases of national emergency or tragedy. What did people do? I mean, did businesses close? Were flags flown at half-mast? Did people stay home from work?
Absolutely. So business seemed to stop, although the only stores that remained open were stores that sold black goods that were for mourning drapery. People would write in their diaries things like, instantly the entire village or city was draped in black. Well, of course it wasn't instant. It was through the labor of various people. So women and workers were up on ladders and hammering black cloth and mourning bunting onto all of the facades. Businesses did close that morning, except, of course, if you sold black goods, and then you took in hundreds of thousands of dollars because everybody wanted to trim their flags with black and put black on their armbands and wear black badges. And so that was another way of proving what had happened, that the landscape was transformed.
But not everybody was grieving. I mean, we think of him today as the iconic president who changed the fate of the nation. Obviously, things were a little more complicated back then.
Yes, that's right. What's so interesting is that Lincoln's mourners write in their journals and letters that everyone, everywhere, all across the nation, even the world, was grieving. But they knew that wasn't true. So first of all, they knew that Confederates weren't grieving. Confederates had mixed feelings about Lincoln, but in many ways they despised him. And so Confederates rejoiced not only in private, but also in public. They thanked God, they cheered, they laughed, they clapped, they taunted African Americans. But the other thing is that there were Northerners, there were white Northerners who despised Lincoln too. These were the Copperheads, his political opponents. And they really confounded this idea of universal grief by laughing and cheering and waving their caps and displaying a kind of joviality that infuriated the mourners.
Was there any kind of punishment for this kind of disrespect?
Yes, there was. In fact, mourners were absolutely infuriated by people who displayed any sort of glee. And so this is both Lincoln's mourners in the North and Union occupiers in the South. So, for example, Union soldiers who are in front of Confederates. So they reacted violently with words and with actions. And Union soldiers who maligned the president, because not all Union soldiers loved Lincoln, were often brought up on charges of treason as an accessory after the fact of the crime. So we have a soldier from Maine who simply said in front of his comrades, "This is too good to believe." We have a soldier from New York who said, "Hip, hip, hurrah, Lincoln is dead." And all of those kinds of words and actions are recorded in these court proceedings.
Wow. Well, how about the mourners? I mean, I think of the 19th century as this time when people were reserved and stoic when it came to emotion. Did they show their grief publicly?
What's so interesting is that the rules of decorum in the 19th century were just as you said, and especially for men. You just weren't supposed to be particularly emotional, especially in public. Well, at this moment of the assassination, all the rules of decorum are just out the window. And especially, people write over and over again in their letters and diaries that men were weeping. Hmm. People write about ministers breaking down. There's an example of a person writes in a diary, "The minister broke down and the tears rolled down his cheeks." There's another example of the minister could only get through the sermon with a violent effort of self-control. That was the phrase this woman used. And men are walking down the streets weeping, wiping their eyes, looking into one another's faces. Women are noticing their husbands crying and writing down that this is the first time they've seen men cry. And people are not ashamed of this. It is such an enormous catastrophe for Lincoln's mourners.
I'm speaking with Martha Hodes about her new book, Mourning Lincoln, which takes a personal look into the lives of ordinary citizens in the aftermath of the assassination of President Lincoln 150 years ago. You also write a lot in the book about the far less recorded population, those of the African American, the slaves, and also those who were free African Americans, their reaction to Lincoln's death. First of all, how did you find these accounts?
Well, it was much more difficult to find written accounts of African Americans. Now, there are African Americans who did, certainly African American soldiers who were literate and wrote letters, and there were some African Americans who kept diaries that have been preserved. But largely, I read African American newspapers in which, for example, soldiers would write letters to the newspapers. And I also read the writings of whites who worked with African Americans. So, for example, Northern missionaries who worked with African Americans during the war down south. and say a teacher was teaching a class and somebody would come in and give the news of the assassination, and then the teacher would write a report back to the Missionary Association recording what people did. So, for example, a young child who said, does this mean we have to be slaves again now that Lincoln is no longer alive? Mm. And we have just bereft Union soldiers, the black men. Also, fear was a response on the part of African Americans. Fear about emancipation, fear about equality, fear about citizenship that they thought might not come to pass now. And of course, free African Americans in the North, they wrote about feeling stricken down and hopeless. And Frederick Douglass called it an unspeakable calamity, the assassination.
Hmm. I'm thinking about times of national tragedy that we can remember. You know, September 11th comes to mind, and you actually write about that a bit in your book. Despite all of the sort of differences between people, between populations, this was a time of unification after September 11th. You know, the country was sort of defiant. How about then? We had a country that had been divided for so long. Did this national tragedy create a kind of balm for those ills or further drive a wedge in between the sides?
Well, what's interesting about 9/11 is that when I was writing this book, I thought back and I remembered it just as you said. I remembered it as a time of national unity. But in fact, when I looked back at the photographs I'd taken in the streets of New York on September 12th, the next morning, I saw all kinds of arguments going on. Some people wanted revenge. Some people wanted peace. Some people didn't want to trust the media. So the signs that I took pictures of made clear this kind of contention. And the same kind of tension and contention was absolutely true in 1865. Mourners might have felt unified, but they were at tremendous odds with Lincoln's enemies and still at tremendous odds with Confederates. There was still a war going on off the battlefield, even though Robert E. Lee had surrendered to Ulysses S. Grant.
The war, of course, claimed the lives of more than 750,000. If you think about the size of the population, that is so significant. And you mentioned in the book that meant nearly everybody knew someone who died in the Civil War. How did that affect how mourners responded to the death of Abraham Lincoln?
Very important. So that figure that you gave is about 2% of the population at the time, which translates into almost what would be today, 7 million lives lost. So as you said, everybody knew somebody. Lincoln's death in some ways seemed like the ultimate death or the last casualty of the Civil War, but it wasn't literally so because men kept dying in Union hospitals and at home and in camp. But Lincoln's funeral and the mourning for Lincoln gave people a chance to publicly express what had just become a parade of one local funeral after another, because his death was such an enormous event that it gave them a moment to express that grief for their own loved ones in a public setting.
How long did this mourning of Lincoln publicly continue?
Well, Lincoln's body was taken on a two-week, 1,700-mile journey after the funeral in Washington, which took place on April 19th, and he was buried. The train took him to his hometown of Springfield, Illinois, where he was buried on May 4th. So all of this went on for 2 weeks, and many of the mourners followed every report about the funeral train, and there were funerals in 11 major cities along the way, and the train passed through many, many towns and villages where people would come to look at it. Then after the funeral was over, people still left up their bunting. They often left it up for weeks after that. Soldiers on their way home from the war would pass through towns and write in their diaries that the mourning bunting was still up from the funeral. People took a long time to give it away, to take it down, so it lingered for quite some time.
Martha Hodes, I want to thank you for joining us. A fascinating topic.
Thank you so much. My pleasure.
Martha Hodes, professor of history at NYU and author of the new book, Mourning Lincoln. We do have a link to more information on the book. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. In addition to devastation and violence, war has the paradoxical effect, producing heroes, many of whom go unrecognized. So while the country today takes time to remember the fallen, we thought it would be appropriate to end the show with an act of quiet heroism, not the kind of courage that gets awarded by medals, but the kind that inspires lifelong gratitude. Rebecca Shear has the story.
All right, so can you start off by showing me what we have here?
Well, I mean, I have tons of pictures.
This is Washington, D.C. resident Cliff Brody.
these are amongst the thousands of pictures here, but you see a young Lieutenant Brody.
Is that you?
That's me.
Oh, my gosh.
And people said, and I didn't realize it then, that I looked very much like Bobby Kennedy.
I was going to say, it's an amazing resemblance.
Yes.
From 1967 to 1968, the young Lieutenant Brody was serving with the 89th Military Police Unit in the U.S. Army in Vietnam.
This picture, I'm carrying a sack of food supplements with a young man named Joe Blakely. Joe was my sergeant. Skinny old Joe or skinny young Joe. A very, very, very slight guy. If he turned sideways, you know, he would disappear.
Both Cliff and skinny old Joe were in their 20s. Cliff hailed from New York and Joe from Philadelphia.
Joe was the nephew of the mayor of Philadelphia, Frank Rizzo. And he was very proud of Uncle Frank. Uncle Frank was a little corrupt, but what can you say?
When Cliff and Joe met in Vietnam, they became fast friends.
We drove around together to villages in what must have been the world's first army Jeep. It was so old and broken down.
The guys were driving around in that same Jeep one day in 1968 when Joe did something, Cliff says,
that saved my sense of being, for which I'm incredibly indebted to him.
The May Offensive, Phase 2 of the Tet Offensive, had begun, and Cliff and Joe were running a convoy of about 24 U.S. Army trucks to Saigon. Their Jeep was in front, a military police vehicle was in back, and Cliff remembers it was an absolutely sweltering day.
You know, it's like 500 degrees outside, we're bedecked with all of this military gear, the steel helmet and everything.
So they were driving, and Cliff and Joe stopped at this one traffic light in the dusty, crowded city. And at that point, Cliff looked in his rearview mirror at the truck behind him, and he saw something kind of unexpected.
This person reaching up under the 2.5-ton truck, and he's grabbing something. So I grab my rifle, my carbine, and Joe's looking at me, and I said, Joe, someone's taking something from that truck.
That something, Cliff quickly realized, was a U.S. Army toolkit. So without even thinking, he leapt out of the Jeep and raced off to catch the presumed thief who had dashed across the road.
And then into a rice paddy, he's got the tools from the Army truck.
Now, our young Lieutenant Brody at this point was angry. It had been more than half a year since he'd been serving in the war. A war, to be frank, he didn't really approve of or even understand.
And my temper wasn't building up. My frustration was.
So that's when Cliff did something he'll never forget. He raised his rifle.
And I put a bullet in the chamber.
And just as he was about to pull the trigger,
Joe comes flying over.
Grabs the gun.
Pulls it down by the barrel.
And says to Lieutenant Brody,
Sir, sir, he says, it's just tools. He's just a kid. I remember the voice. It's just a kid.
And that, Cliff says, is when reality set in.
If I had shot the boy, I would have never been happy with myself. Never. I would have run from the memory like I've run from a lot of other memories, but it would find its way to the surface.
Hence his eternal indebtedness to one Sergeant Joe Blakely.
Joe was my conscience, obviously, at that moment. People do things, so we're all told, in the heat of war, and I certainly saw the evidence of that while I was in Vietnam. We all do things we regret. That would have been a big one.
After the war, Cliff Brody served in the Foreign Service and lost touch with Joe Blakely. Cliff's done a little research, though, and it seems skinny old Joe died in 1988. What would you say to Joe right now if he were able to listen?
Joe, I don't think you have any idea of how much your being there at that time made me much more able to live with who I am. Thank you.
Cliff has been pretty big on thank yous ever since that fateful day in May 68, and he believes we all should be.
I think it's useful from time to time to look back on events in your life and answer the question, who has helped me become a better person? And then we should say, well, how do we pay those people back? In my opinion, you don't. There's no way to pay those people back. Some of them have moved on. Some of them have died. So the payback is by doing the same thing for someone else.
I'm Rebecca Shear.
Thank you for your listening time on this Memorial Day holiday. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And you can never miss a show by signing up for the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR on iTunes. And if you like the podcast, tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Enjoy your holiday weekend and join us for more Word of Mouth next time on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray,
with help from our intern,
Katie McAuliffe.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.